We are now in the longest war that Israel has ever fought since it established itself as a nation more than 70 years ago. We're looking at more than 30,000 Palestinians killed. The scale of the horrors of this war are so staggering that some days I feel that I have no words left to describe what's happening.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Battle Lines.
Regardless of who stands with Israel, Israel will fight until this battle is won.
I've made wartime decisions. I know the choices are never clear or easy for the leadership.
I just find bombs and I find dead people, but it's a really scary thing for me.
In this episode of Battle Lines, we reflect on the upcoming 6th month anniversary of the October the 7th attacks in Israel that sparked an invasion of Gaza. We speak to The Telegraph's Middle East correspondent, Natalia Vasilieva, and senior foreign correspondent, Sophia Yan, as they look back on the past 6 months and ask what the future holds for Israel, Hamas, and a Palestinian state. It's Friday, the 5th of April, 2024. Hi, Natalia and Sophia. Thank you so much for your time. Just to explain, we've got a list of questions that Venetia and myself and our producer David have been coming up with to try and really understand this conflict from as many angles as possible. And we've also included a few questions that listeners have sent in themselves. Let's jump in. Our first question speaks about the situation in Israel before the October the 7th attacks. Can we remind our listeners about the environment just shortly before the October 7th attacks? What were conditions like in Gaza? And how was the temperature between Hamas and Israel? Were there any signs that an attack of this scale was inevitable?
Hi, David, and hi, everyone. Great question. And I would say there was a certain lull before the storm. And I myself arrived in Israel 12 days before the attack. And I remember those conversations with my predecessor, James Rothwell, who I took over from 5 days before the attack, and other people. And people were like throwing around ideas about what's important right now. And I don't remember a single person mentioning Gaza. No one told me you should be very careful of Gaza, something is happening. But there was a big political.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Post story about Benjamin Netanyahu and anti-government protests and the judicial reform he was trying to push through. Gaza was pretty much stable as it could be. There was a short-lived bombing campaign in 2021. Obviously, nothing compared to the scale that we're seeing in Gaza right now. And from my conversations with people at the time and from what we're hearing right now from snippets about the ongoing investigation, there was this idea that Hamas would not want an all-out war. It wasn't about that it didn't have the capabilities to unleash this kind of massacre, but there was this idea that the Hamas leadership is too pragmatic and any attack like that would be suicidal. So that was the thinking around the time of the attack.
Well, let's talk more in detail then about Benjamin Netanyahu. We've got a question here that brings us up to date. Can you tell us about Netanyahu's popularity? Where was it before October the 7th? And where are we today?
Netanyahu has been increasingly popular for a very long time. There was a massive wave of protests last year in 2022, starting pretty much in January. So most of last year was consumed by those anti-government protests, which were immediately triggered by Netanyahu's decision to push through a judicial reform. But at that time, Israel saw unprecedented protests weekend after weekend, Tel Aviv and Jerusalem are the big cities paralyzed by protesters. Again, we could see that Netanyahu was losing popularity, but overall, his approval ratings were definitely nowhere near as low as they are. If you look at polling figures right now, and I could talk about it later, right now as little as 35, I think the latest poll said, 35% of Israelis say that they would like to see Netanyahu as prime minister. Before October the 7th, even during the opposition protests, Netanyahu's popularity was definitely much higher. You could talk about 40 or 50%, but not 35.
We'll come back to Netanyahu later, I think. But Sophia Yan, can I come to you? We've got a question here on Hamas. To sum it up, is Hamas likely to be eradicated? If so, then who else could we see represent the Palestinian people? And who is filling the security vacuum left behind in Palestine?
These are all the million-dollar questions. First, there's a big debate on whether Hamas itself can be eradicated. On one hand, the Israeli military can certainly keep going until all senior Hamas leadership, that every single person up there, that they're all killed. And so far, they have indeed made some gains on this front. But on the other hand, what is the long-term impact of what Israel is doing? Many people have pointed this out, that Hamas does not exist in a vacuum. What happened on October 7th was absolutely atrocious. There's no question about that. But if you pull back, there is a reason that Hamas militants felt the need to perpetrate such an attack, that they felt compelled to do so. This deep-rooted hatred for Jewish Israelis, it didn't come from nowhere. Some of these gunmen, we know their profiles. They were quite young, for instance, in their early 20s. And that means they were children in the last major Gaza war back in 2014. Consider coming of age like that. It's not a far stretch to see why someone with such experiences might very sadly grow up wanting revenge or justice. We are now in the longest war that Israel has ever fought since it established itself as a nation more than 70 years ago. We're looking at more than 30,000 Palestinians killed. The scale of the horrors of this war are so staggering that some days I feel that I have no words left to describe what's happening. So how will the children who have been displaced, the ones who are at risk of dying from starvation, they don't have enough water to drink, possibly lost a parent or both, at the very least a family member, how are they going to feel about Israel when they grow up? This is a very big question. And in that sense, that sentiment of quote-unquote Hamas perhaps cannot be eradicated. The second point about what happens next, after this war ends, who could take the lead for the Palestinians? This is something that has not been discussed deeply enough. It's what everyone refers to as the day after. Right now, in the midst of war, and the threat that this war will tip into a very widespread regional conflict, it's kept everyone so busy. The day-to-day, the breaking news of this, it's something that you can't take your eyes away from. Everyone's worried, and it's very hard to think much further down the line. Part of the reason, though, this question has not been fully addressed is because it really means answering, will the world allow a state of Palestine to exist? Will there be a two-state solution? Finally, Netanyahu has said that he wants Israel to maintain indefinite overall security responsibility in Gaza, but hasn't elaborated much on what that would look like. There's talk of a buffer zone, a wider border, essentially, that would make it harder for people to make it across. But at this point, it's pretty clear that most Palestinians, if not all of them, would reject the idea of Israeli authorities remaining in power. There's also the big question of who exactly would be in charge. Hamas is likely to be considered by many governments around the world to be far too volatile an actor to be in any position of authority. Support is waning for the Palestinian Authority, though the West, particularly the U.S., has made noises to the effect of having them in place to run, to govern. What probably needs to happen and probably what should happen is some interim Palestinian government in place to administer some form of governance. Once the fighting stops, we're talking about everything from relaying water pipes to rebuilding hospitals. There needs to be a lot of work done from these sorts of practical matters and then more political ones. What does a precursor to Palestinian statehood look like? How do we get there? And this again loops us back to the question whose resolution has eluded the world now for so many decades, which is, will a state of Palestine be established?
There's a question from me now that I think will bring us up to date. This week has seen several huge developments. We've seen the end of the second al-Shifa hospital raid. We've seen an Israeli strike that killed a top Iranian commander in Syria. And we've also seen the killing of several aid workers, including three Brits, in the Gaza Strip. What do these things tell us about the development of the war, the death of war, and how it's going? Sophia and Natalia, would you like to both answer that? But maybe come to Natalia first.
Sure. I would say the end of the siege on Al-Shifa Hospital, it's quite symbolic because we're now almost 6 months into this war. And if someone was following this conflict closer, the ground operation started at the end of October. By the end of November, Israeli forces were already controlling Gaza City. And Al-Shifa sits in Gaza City. It's the biggest hospital. And around the time, we already started to hear from Israeli officials that they were in control of the north of Gaza. We thought that the control was established early December at the latest. And it just goes back to the point that Sophia was making, that whatever Israel says, whatever the goals are, they don't appear to be realistic right now, because the area which should have been and was supposed to be under Israeli control, as the IDF admits, now turned into a hotbed of terrorism. As we could see, the Al-Shifa hospital sustained great damage. Apparently, there's a great number of civilians who've been killed and dead bodies found on the premises of the hospital. This is one fact, but there's another fact. Apparently, they were some Hamas and Palestinian Jihad gunmen who had holed up on the premises. Israel arrested something like 500 gunmen. They have released videos with video testimony for some of them, and it does look that they were armed people on the premises. It just shows that all of the devastation that has been unleashed on Gaza, when the way you look at it, you know, you get to question it and see what was it really worth it, that 4 months after Israel was supposed to be in control of the north of Gaza, it has to go back again and kill even more people in order to stem another Hamas cell. That's what it tells us about the broader situation, I think.
Thank you so much, Natalia. Sophia, do you want to take up the killing of the foreign aid workers?
Really underscores very serious concerns that Israel can no longer be restrained, that the military is targeting so indiscriminately at this point out of rage in response to the October 7 attacks, and that rage and these offensives are leading now to a very staggering loss of human life. And again, I just often many days feel speechless in how to describe the scale of what's going on at this point. This kind of behavior from the Israelis is really beginning to impact its relations with the West. Senior officials from the UK, also the US, Israel's strongest ally, have all made comments that essentially Israel has gone too far, that it cannot keep acting with such impunity. This is a message, though, that Israel continues to reject. In my reporting over these 6 months, countless people I've talked to really truly feel that Israel remains justified in its use of force in responding to Hamas because of what happened on the 7th. And so there's a sense that no matter how bloody things get, the Israeli military needs to act in this way.
One of our listeners sent in a question in which they allude to the controversy, I think it's fair to say, surrounding how do we count the casualties, how do we count the dead in Gaza. So we've sort of slightly reformulated Jan's question, but here it is. Why is the death toll so high? Why have so many children been killed? What is the challenge in validating these numbers, as Hamas and Israel obviously differ in their estimations?
That's a very good question. I mean, we started seeing very high casualties, number of casualties from the start. And I think something like in the 4 months of the war, I think by January, I remember the death toll hitting the 30,000 people. Israel has been targeting this one tiny piece of land. You're not talking about a big country like Ukraine. It's a very densely populated area. It's one of the densest populated areas in the world. From what we know from people on the ground, from multiple video and photo evidence, we saw that Israeli airstrikes were destroying entire neighborhoods. So if you imagine people holding up in those areas, they all would be killed. Also, unlike in Ukraine, there are no air raid shelters. There's not a single air raid shelter. There's no place for civilians to hide. In Ukraine, you can see pictures of civilians seeking shelter in the metro, somewhere else, but there's absolutely nowhere for civilians to hide in Gaza. I remember a lot of skepticism about the death toll, especially at the start. The challenge here is that international journalists, there's a limited access to international organizations. So the verification is quite hard. it's not like you can say reporters from Reuters, AP, and Daily Telegraph were on the scene and actually counted the bodies. We are not able to do this job. We are not allowed into Gaza unless you go with an IDF embed. The question, the point about the high number of women and children. Gaza is a very young place. I actually specifically looked up some demographic figures for Gaza. And it's quite staggering if you compare it to, for example, if you take the median age in the UK, in Israel, and compare it to Gaza. In the UK, the average person in the UK is aged 40. In Israel, the average person is aged 29. In Gaza, the median age is 18. It was 18 in 2020. And 40% of Gaza's population in 2020 was 14 years old. So you naturally have a lot of kids and a lot of young people.
One more question for you, Natalia, before we go back to Sophia to sort of zoom out slightly from Israel and Gaza. But a simple question, really. How is the war covered in Israel? What do you read in Israeli newspapers and see on Israeli television?
Yeah, I think it's a very painful question to ask the Israeli public. In the immediate aftermath of October the 7th, I can totally understand that Israelis were too traumatized and too focused on the massacre that happened on their doorstep. It's a small country. It's very hard to find someone who was not affected by that. People know people who were killed in southern Israel. People know someone who have been taken hostage, or they know someone whose relatives have been taken hostage. So they were very much focused on that at the start of the war. And there was not much coverage of the war on Gaza from the very start. But months have passed, and we still see very little coverage of what is going on in Gaza. Basically, the average TV viewer in Israel doesn't know what's happening in Gaza, which leads us to a big philosophical question. Is this about not knowing, not having access to the information, or not wanting to know what's happening on the other side of the border fence? Unlike Russia, where I come from, Israel is a democracy. It has free media. You can go out and protest. There are frequent peace protests just, you know, a couple of streets away from me. There are papers who do offer coverage for the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. You can pick up those papers from a kiosk. They're not banned. They're not harassed. But the idea is that those papers are considered left-wing. They are considered to be a bit marginal, even more marginal now. And the mainstream ignores the suffering of civilians in Gaza. So your average Israeli wouldn't know about it, or would not want to know what's going on the other side.
Let's zoom out then. Sophia Yan, question here. What about the knock-on effect in Yemen with the Houthi attacks? How significant has that been, and is it likely to continue?
They have been very significant. The Houthis have emerged as a significant fighting force. They have more firepower than really acknowledged before this war. And clearly, they're now a group whose activities are not isolated to just their home base of Yemen. That they have been able to, in these last few months, completely disrupt global shipping with their attacks into the Red Sea itself is all you need to understand to know that the Houthis can indeed make a very big impact. The other point to understand is that so far, it appears their activities have actually helped their popularity. The Houthis are gaining off the fact that the U.S. recently renewed a terrorist designation for the group. They're capitalizing off the fact that other nations consider them a threat. Now, the Houthis say they're acting in solidarity with the Palestinians, and until Israel backs off on Gaza, that those attacks will continue into the Red Sea. There's no reason to doubt what the Houthis are saying, but there is a question of whether they will actually back off once Israel stops. And that's something that can't be answered until the Israeli military does pull out of Gaza to the extent that the Houthis will consider acceptable.
Let's move, I think, now to some questions really about your reporting and your experience in this. Can I ask you both, is there an element to the war that you think has been undercovered?
Yeah, there are lots of blind spots here, especially in Gaza, because 6 months into the war, Israel has not hasn't let international journalists enter. We have not been able to do independent reporting. All we have to do is to rely on local sources, on local stringers. So we're not able to go there and see it for ourselves, which again opens us to lots of blind spots. So a lot of things that have been undercovered, I think it's what's happening on the ground in Gaza. What I personally is very much interested in, and I don't have answers to that question, is the sentiment against Hamas, or the local sentiment about Hamas. When we have seen pictures and footage of sporadic, tiny little protests here and there, people shouting slogans against Yahya Sinwar or other Hamas leaders, understandably for bringing the disaster on their heads because Gaza was not under such a massive attack before October the 7th. We don't know much about it, and I understand that people who live there might be hesitant to talk, but I think this idea of sentiment about Hamas and public opinion about how they see Gaza ruled after the war, I think this is something very much overlooked right now.
Sophia.
I want to underline something that Natasha highlighted, which is that the access to Gaza is essentially non-existent unless you're going in with the Israeli military. And that has meant a very disproportionate share of the burden of covering this well has fallen to journalists, Palestinian journalists in Gaza. And so far in this war, we've seen a very high death toll for those journalists as well. And without them, we would have actually very little insight into what's happening within the Gaza Strip itself. Now, in terms of what other issues have been undercovered, definitely what the day after could look like, which I discussed earlier. But the long-term view that I keep tossing over and over in my mind is this question of what radicalizes a person. I keep thinking about what the future looks like beyond the day after. Can the world heal from such a divide? Israel-Palestine is possibly the most divisive issue in the world, period. And now with all these horrific things that have happened, October 7th itself, this ongoing war, can Jews, can Palestinians, can the rest of the world, for that matter, heal from such trauma? This is a question mark that I just cannot stop thinking about. And I'm not the only one. This is something that will impact the next generation, possibly many more generations down the road.
Can I ask you both, what are your reflections over the past 6 months? What's also, I'm kind of very interested, what's taken you by surprise when covering this? What's happened that you didn't expect?
Oh, that's a big one. I have to say that I was feeling pessimistic about it from the start. So I did see a long war. You know that most of my colleagues didn't see a long war. They were all telling me, you know, Israel doesn't do long wars. They all go in, do it quickly and leave. I did see a long war. I guess what I did not expect is of those cross-border clashes between Hezbollah and Israel to carry on. And they've been, it's pretty much been a daily occurrence since. And in recent weeks, we've seen escalation under escalation. And now we're at the point when there's an increasing talk of a second front in the north. There's an increasing talk of a war with Hezbollah. So I definitely, when it kicked off, definitely didn't see a second major war breaking at the same time, but it is looking increasingly likely.
So I was definitely in the camp on the other side of what Natalia was saying. I did think that, I didn't imagine that this would go on as long as it has, that we're now at 6 months is really bewildering. It feels like not that long ago we were doing coverage at 1 month of war or 2 months of war. This is something that is so unprecedented. Again, it's the longest war that Israel has engaged in since it established itself as a state more than 7 decades ago. And that the Israeli military is still fighting the way it is, it reflects how much rage there is because of these deadly attacks last October. Something that doesn't always come across in news coverage is the sense of how this is the sense of a pact that the Israeli government and the military had with their people, the sense of security, the sense that everything would be fine. This was completely broken on the 7th for the general public and possibly even for the military itself. That this could happen is something that is so shocking to Israelis. And how they're reacting now does show that particular surprise that they have themselves over what was always promised, essentially, that they could live there and be safe. So this 6 month mark, I think, is really one to take stock of, because at first there was a lot of support for Israel in the sense that this was something so terrible to have all these hostages taken, to see the murderous way people were killed. This was very much premeditated. It took very dark minds to orchestrate and then to execute. And in the very beginning, so much of the world was on side with Israel in that respect. There was a sense that, yes, something must be done, that there must be a response. But now as time has gone on, there's a question of whether or not Israel is actually achieving what it says it wants to achieve, to eradicate Hamas, to make sure there are no security threats, et cetera, et cetera. Well, now that there's a debate as to whether or not Israel can achieve those goals and the death toll is ticking up and there's more pushback over what it's doing because of this catastrophic situation that we find ourselves in, the fact that Israel has not been willing to pull back or to listen to anybody else, it seems, even to the U.S., its strongest supporter. I mean, this is really something I think going forward needs to be considered as part of the context when you're looking at the whole story.
How does this conflict compare to others that you may have covered?
Yeah, I would say if there's one thing I was asked to highlight is the utter sense of hopelessness and no vision in sight, no end in sight to not just to the particular war in Gaza, but to the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict that has been going on since pretty much 1948. I would say another thing that really makes it different from all of the conflicts I have covered and seen is that we're dealing with a conflict in one densely populated area from which people have no way of fleeing. We have seen refugees from Ukraine, from Syria. They could get out. Obviously, it was horrible and difficult, but they were able to get out of the area where they were being bombed. In Gaza, it's completely different. This area is sealed. They cannot go to Israel. They cannot get to Egypt. Those borders are sealed. And unless you're a foreign national and your departure is approved by all parties through Egypt, or unless you pay a bribe, which has also been a practice, you're stuck there. There's no way for you to run.
Sophia.
I agree with Natalia. There's honestly no comparison. To be blunt, all wars, uprisings, conflicts, they're terrifying. And the human toll is always so much worse than you could ever imagine, than what the news could possibly impart. What we present to the world is the best we can do. But for the people who are living through this, this is, I mean, again, there are no words. And this is a war that will, again, define a generation, maybe many more going forward. I think this is so problematic and divisive in the sense that many countries around the world now have mixed communities. So many people no longer live where they're from. In the UK, in the US, we've got Jews, we've got Palestinians, we've got Syrians, we've got Afghans, we've got Muslims, we've got Jews, we've got Christians. I mean, this is a globalized world that we live in today. Migrants, immigrants, refugees, digital nomads. I mean, there are a lot of terms out there to describe this movement of people. And that means whether we like it or not, we're encountering people from many walks of life every single day. Governments going forward need to think deeply about what this war means in the long term. What will this war do to the social fabric of the world as we know it? Are there security risks? Are there people now so disillusioned and angry and upset with what's happening that they become ripe for potential recruitment by bad actors in the future? What is the risk of future deadly attacks from people who are so impacted by what's going on today? For Palestinians, a lot of them have told me that this is a second Nakba. And this is coming at a time when they're still healing from the first Nakba. So this is piling on. And the impact on the world, from my perspective, I think it's something that we cannot even fathom right now, the full impact of this war into the future. And I'm talking not tomorrow or not in a year, but I'm talking 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the line, maybe even more. This war is going to have so much of a consequence for all of us. It's impossible to really know to what extent, but it really is going to seed this division for a very long time going forward.
Thank you so much, Sophia and Natalia. Final few questions now, just to bring us, I think, up to date and leave our listeners with a sense that we're looking ahead to the next few weeks, the next few months. Very simple question. Why have negotiations between Israel and Hamas been stuck for so many months?
It's a tough one. I mean, the longer it takes, it looks like the less willing Israel is compromised, it's willing to compromise, despite the fact that relatives of the hostages have been increasingly active. They now have been rallying every day in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, demanding a hostage deal. But at the same time, a deal with Hamas would require a certain compromise on the part of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And as we have seen, his far-right allies have been threatening him, warning him about a potential hostage deal, saying that if he agrees to something that they are opposed to, they could walk out of the government, collapsing the government coalition, and Israel would be facing a new election. So I guess the consensus opinion in Israel right now is that, unfortunately, the fate of the hostage deal now depends on Prime Minister Netanyahu and his political survival, and him prioritizing his political survival over compromises that could be painful to Israel, including releasing hundreds of Palestinian prisoners, but getting Israeli hostages in return, at least some of them, back.
Well, let's stay with Netanyahu. I know we said earlier we'd come back to him, but Natalia, how long can he realistically survive in his post? And do we have any sense of who might realistically replace him?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Just as we got onto this podcast, I just saw a news flash from Benny Gantz, Israel's most popular politician right now and member of the security cabinet, who says that he would like to see a general elections in September, which is something new. He has been quite diplomatic all this time. I mean, he could have urged for an election, but he has not been doing that. So apparently this is how he's reacting to anti-government protests. If you look at the opinion polls, the latest results that I saw last week shows 45% supporting Benny Gantz as a prime minister, as opposed to Benjamin Netanyahu. So obviously, if you look at those numbers, you can see that Netanyahu's days as the leader of the country are numbered. It's a matter of when to hold the next elections. And the consensus has been so far that Israel should sit tight and not change horses midstream in the middle of this crucial war for Israel. And even people like Gantz, who would definitely win if there was an election tomorrow, they've been quite restrained and tried to wait it out. There was an idea that, you know, Netanyahu would go as soon as the war is over. But now that the war is about to enter its seventh month, it looks like even Benny Gantz is losing his patience.
Well, then finally, for both of you, what does a long-term peace plan look like? How do you see this conflict resolving? Sophia, would you like to go first?
There may be no other possibility other than finally reaching a scenario where there is a state of Palestine. Whether or not there's a political appetite for that is a totally different question. But in what situation can you imagine, can anyone imagine that Palestinians will allow Israel to stay in power after what has happened? From the Palestinian perspective, Israel simply can't be trusted. From the Israeli side, there's a similar concern too. If the Palestinians have statehood, can they manage their own affairs? Will there still be a security risk? These are really big questions that need to be talked about openly, that need to be talked about with both sides at the table. And again, we're still in the middle of very brutal war. It's hard to have those discussions. But at this point, there may be no answer but to have a state of Palestine. The Spanish prime minister said this week that his country will recognize Palestine as a state by July. And so this is actually a pretty definitive statement. We'll see if it happens. There are signs that this is the direction things may start to move in now.
Natalia, would you like the final words on this?
Yeah, I think right now, 6 months into this war, it looks like time is not on the side of Israel. And just like this week's deaths of aid workers showed, every single incident like that, support for Israel from its staunchest allies is eroding. So it looks like Israel is really running out of time for the time it has in Gaza. I think whenever there's a ceasefire, there's definitely going to be a ceasefire. Obviously, all wars end at the same time. From what we're seeing right now, it looks like Israel first will try to establish a buffer zone, as Sophia mentioned earlier. There is a buffer zone already there, and we actually did a story about it a couple of months ago, looking at satellite images, which show a sort of strip of devastation just on the border, running along the border between Israel and Gaza. And it's quite visible that Israel has obviously specifically been clearing out this area for a potential border zone, buffer zone. So I think what we're going to see first, we're going to see a buffer zone. Then we're going to see Israeli troops trying to manage the most basic needs, maybe take part in distributing humanitarian aid. What we've been hearing from Israeli officials lately is that there's some willingness to bring in partners from across the Muslim world, probably the Emirates. Egypt tried to bring in something to govern this area. I don't think we're talking about the Palestinian state at this point. Obviously, this is a prospect, but not something on the horizon right now. And it looks like the Americans are going to be trying and pushing Israel to look for local partners in Gaza, to look for Palestinians in Gaza who are not affiliated with Hamas and who will be able to run this area day to day, whereas Israel will be definitely retaining full security control over this area, which probably means that there will be troops stationed there, at least some number of troops for quite a long time.
Thank you so much, Nassalia and Sophia, for your answers and for your time. Are there any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners with on this, the approaching the sixth anniversary of the start of the war?
I think we need to pay a lot of attention to what's happening in the north of Israel. Just in a couple of weeks, we have seen a massive escalation across the Israeli-Lebanese border. Israel killed several senior figures from Hezbollah and from Iran in recent weeks. There was a senior Syrian general assassinated. There was a general in the Iranian Revolutionary Guards assassinated a couple of days ago, which in peacetime would be considered as a massive escalation and would trigger some sort of response from Iran or its proxies like Hezbollah. So whatever is happening on the ground in Gaza, I think this is something not to overlook and pay a lot of attention to, because this is a very dangerous area potentially.
Sophia Yan and Natalia Vasilyeva, thank you so much for your time.
Battle Lines is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our news, analysis and dispatches from around the world, subscribe to The Telegraph or sign up to Dispatches, which brings stories from our award-winning correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a live blog on our website where you can follow updates on Israel and Gaza as they come in throughout the day, including insight from contributors to this podcast. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Battle Lines on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it really helps others find the show. As disinformation is a particular problem during conflict, we are relying on your support more than ever. Battle Lines is part of wider Telegraph foreign coverage in our podcasts. If you're interested in finding out more about the war in Ukraine, you can listen to our sister podcast, Ukraine the Latest. Battle Lines is produced by David Degahi, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.